of thousands.
Reynolds, how did you get the clemency? You'd already been in jail for what, like 18 years?
Yes. Well, the process began long before I even filed paperwork. I worked for a lady in the education department. Her name was Janice Feaster. I was a tutor. And, you know, we had dialogue. And a guy, Pryor Reed, President Bush had pardoned him. He had a life sentence. He had been in prison for 8 years. And so when we said, when she told me what happened with him, because he worked with us as a leisure library clerk, she told me that, why don't you file for clemency? Your story is a different kind of story. And, you know, at the time, you know, facing all the things from my own past and still being held accountable for it, you know, it was hard for me to see, why would they give me another chance? You know, I had faced issues in prison, such as classes. Okay. And so it was a process. I'm glad that I had a great support group. And then I had an attorney, my Angel Cody, that said, yes, she would help me.
Well, we will continue to follow what happens this week with President Obama being the first sitting president to visit a prison, that in Oklahoma. Reynolds Wintersmith and Cynthia Roseberry, thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Hani Massoud, Robbie Caron, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, on the line at www.kboo.fm. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday Evening News coming up next.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Tuesday nights on KBOO, it's Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush.
With DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid.
10 p.m. to midnight.
2 hours of global bass featuring Bhangra, Bollywood,
and the urban sounds of the global diaspora. You're done north!
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an agreement has been reached with Iran to end the dispute over its nuclear program.
Legislation to prevent states from mandating the labeling of food products containing GMO ingredients is going to the floor of the House.
And the Tigard Tualatin School District is setting discipline standards for off-campus hate speech. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 14th, 2015. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. The organization 15 Now Oregon has released a report card evaluating how state legislators performed this year regarding the effort to raise the minimum wage. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Justin Norton Kurtzton of 15 Now PDX to learn more.
Well, for the most part, Portland area legislators did okay. One of our base criteria was whether or not legislators endorsed the $15 ballot measure, as well as whether they, you know, were out in public actively speaking in favor of it and doing work to help further the bills. So most of the Portland area legislators came on as sponsors of the bill before the legislative session even started. So, you know, people like Michael Denbrough, Rob Nose, Chip Shields, they all got A's or A minuses. Ann Leininger and Lou Fredericks got B pluses. And a number of other legislators, Kenny Guyer, Barbara Smith Warner, all got got B, B minuses, or B pluses. One notable exception in the Portland area was Tina Kotek. We actually gave her a D because, well, for one, she didn't sponsor the $15 bills. In fact, she didn't sponsor any of the minimum wage bills, and really stayed silent for the most part throughout the whole legislative session on the issue. And it wasn't until the very end, when it was really too late, right, in like the last week of the session, that she came out with a proposal for 13 and lifting preemption. But you know, too little, too late is not being bold. It's being, well, like we say in the article, kind of opportunistic.
Now, how did the legislature do as a whole?
As a whole, well, we didn't really grade Republicans because there weren't any Republicans that came out in favor of raising the minimum wage at all, let alone 15. So we just sort of left them off the list. Among Democrats, you know, there were about 15, 16 or so that got A's or B's. No one got an A plus. You know, Denbro got an A himself, but you know, we still feel that there's room for improvement. So we felt that he didn't necessarily warrant an A plus. But there were a lot of D's and C's and F's as well, either because people actively came out against the $15 minimum wage or just because they really didn't do anything to help further the conversation at all. And one really big piece of the sort of the grading puzzle for us was that a lot of these legislators, when they were up for their last reelection campaigns, they were campaigning on raising the minimum wage. And to have such large majorities in both houses coming out of the election and to really not even make an effort to do anything is really sort of a slap in the face of the people who voted for them and supported them.
Now, the initiative, how is that effort going?
It's going great. On June 30th, we submitted our first 2,000 signatures to qualify for a ballot title. So we expect any day now that we will be finding out whether we had enough valid signatures for that. And then once that's done, we go into the process of actually getting the ballot title, which could take a while depending on whether the opposition challenges the ballot title that the attorney general writes.
So now, how are efforts going here locally in Portland?
Things are really, really heating up here in Portland. We had two really big actions on April 15th and on June 17th. The April 15th one, right, was part of a National Day of Action, as well as the June 17th Justice for Janitors event. There are a lot of groups of workers here in the Portland area that are fighting for 15 in their workplaces, at the bargaining table. And there's a whole coalition of groups, led by 15 Now and Jobs with Justice and labor unions here in the city. That are pushing for a really broad campaign to win a $15 minimum wage for 30,000 out of the 120,000 people in the Portland area that don't make $15 an hour. And we're looking to do that over the next 2 years. So the campaign is really heating up and things are going to get really exciting here over the next year.
All right. Well, we'll keep in touch to see how things go. I've been speaking with Justin Norton Kurtzen from the 15 Now PDX organization. Justin, thank you so much.
Yep, thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Oregon may be the second state in the U.S. after Tennessee to provide 2 years of free college education. The bill, called the Oregon Promise, has already been pushed through the Oregon State Legislature, and Governor Kate Brown is expected to sign it this week. If the bill gets signed into law, the state will spend $10 million a year to fill in the tuition gaps that state and federal aid don't cover. In addition to tuition fees, eligible community college students will receive a minimum grant of $1,000 to cover travel costs, textbooks, and more. The Oregon Promise Bill is said to be able to help 70,000 people in Oregon by better enabling them to enter the workforce. President Obama also took inspiration from Tennessee's bill, launching a nationwide initiative called America's College Promise. He hopes that 9 million students will be able to receive higher education. However, the proposal may be halted by the Republican-controlled Congress, who worries about the hit that taxpayers could receive.
The Tiger Tualatin School District has moved to set discipline standards for hateful off-campus speech. School board members voted on June 8th to expand the district's definition of inappropriate language to account for both on-campus and online incidents. The policy emphasizes that any speech that creates a disruption to the school environment will receive disciplinary measures. The change in policy was prompted by an incident earlier this year when students began sharing an image of a fake Tualatin High School website changed to host racist content. There have been many complaints of the new disciplinary policy having possible infringements on First Amendment rights. Jan Carson, associate director with the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, thinks that enforcing the policy will be tricky. Carson says that it's always difficult for a school to regulate off-campus speech without running into First Amendment violations. Students have free speech rights. Deciding when to discipline will come down to school district determining what is a substantial disruption to the learning environment and what is an identifiable threat of school violence.
A sense of purpose for returning veterans is key to their successful reentry into civilian life, but options can be few in rural Oregon. In the Bend area, a nonprofit group is moving forward with plans for a sustainable farm and ranch, a veterans hospice facility, with a goal of staffing them with veterans. KABU reporter Shade Samuelson has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Veterans and community members in the Bend area are meeting this week to make plans for a sustainable farming operation as part of the Central Oregon Veterans Ranch. Since 2013, the nonprofit group has worked to create a combination farm and ranch on land purchased outside of Bend, and a four-bedroom home on the property is being converted into a hospice for veterans needing end-of-life care. The idea is to staff it with veterans. Now it's time to decide which types of crops to grow and animals to raise. Founder Allison Perry says the group pondering those questions is a good mix.
There's kind of this blending of the old guard and more conservative, and then there's also people who've tried innovative things and have learned by trial and error. And then there are people like me, or complete idealists, who say, let's do it, regardless of how hard it is.
Options being considered for the ranch include the Navajo Churro, a hardy breed of rare sheep, as well as raising lavender, hops, and bees on the land. Perry says a greenhouse is on the future wish list to allow for growing vegetables. The planning meeting takes place this Friday. Perry notes it would be easier to use conventional farming methods, but that isn't what the group has in mind. Instead, they've decided on permaculture, working with the land instead of changing it to create certain growing conditions. As a trauma therapist who worked for the VA for 6 years, Perry says for veterans recovering from trauma, the approach is a learning experience on several levels.
There's a very interesting mindfulness in permaculture or sustainable agriculture practices that require taking your time. It's a much more relational process. It's systems-based, so you're looking at how systems work together.
Perry says they'd like to put a tiny house on the property for a foreman as finances permit and the farm and ranch operations get up and running. The Central Oregon Veterans Ranch Hospice facility should be open by year's end. For KABU News, I'm Shade Samuelson.
At its meeting this week, the Portland City Council confirmed a list of members nominated for its Socially Responsible Investments Committee. The Socially Responsible Investments Committee was created by the council in December 2014. The committee will be responsible for recommending companies for the city's corporate securities Do Not Buy list. The Do Not Buy list is approved by the council annually and lists the companies in which the city will not directly invest its own money. The committee must make recommendations consistent with socially responsible values as laid out by the city council. These values include environmental concerns, health concerns, concerns about abusive labor practices, corrupt corporate ethics, tax avoidance, and concerns about impacts on human rights. The seven volunteer members of the Socially Responsible Investments Committee have expertise in environmental issues, labor practices, corporate ethics and governance, and public health and safety. All committee meetings will be open to the public and will be posted on their webpage at www.portlandoregon.gov.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Leaders of large business corporations are getting bolder and bolder by the month, no longer playing nice because they no longer have to. Their political and legal power has reached such a point that they no longer have to plead with governments to get their demands met. They simply hire their own people into positions of elected or appointed government. Or they simply and directly write the laws that politicians then pass overwhelmingly, be they Democrat or Republican. Or their directors simply write the regulatory laws that are designed to regulate that very industry. And let's not kid ourselves, both mainstream parties support this system overwhelmingly. One of my favorite revolutionists, Noam Chomsky, describes the situation this way, quote, "In the U.S., there's basically one party, the Business Party. It has two factions, called Democrats and Republicans," unquote. I couldn't have said that better myself. The very first major piece of legislation ever to have been actually written by corporate leaders and for our Congress and Senate to pass was the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And boy, what a doozy it was. In printed form, the act was as thick as the New York City telephone directory, so of course very few politicians ever read it before they voted yes in overwhelming numbers. The leaders of the media corporations claimed at the time that it was a no-brainer piece of legislation necessary to modernize telecommunications law, but in reality it was a wet dream for the corporate elite. Buried in this massive piece of new legislation was Section 704 that banned local governments from even considering the potential human or environmental health impact of a proposed cell tower in their decision-making process, because that consideration would violate the corporation's civil rights. Yes, that's right. The telecommunications industry's leaders argued that the corporations they owned were people just like historically oppressed African Americans, and therefore the 1964 Civil Rights Act protected the corporation's civil rights against discrimination by race, religion, or gender. Since that day, it's been close to impossible for a local government to stop the building of or the extension of a cell tower. And how about those upcoming presidential debates? They used to be moderated by the unimpeachably honest League of Women Voters, but back in 1988, the League was unceremoniously tossed out of their historic role and replaced by the Commission on Presidential Debates, which sounds like a pretty reputable organization until you discover that this commission is literally owned and operated by the same two political parties that are the only parties allowed to participate in the debates, the Republicans and the Democrats. In a 1988 press release, the president of the League of Women Voters stated that they were, quote, withdrawing their sponsorship of the presidential debate because the demands of the two campaign organizations would perpetrate a fraud on the American people. It has become clear to us that the candidates' organizations aim to add debates to their list of campaign trail charades, devoid of substance, spontaneity, and honest answers to tough questions. The League has no intention of becoming an accessory to the hoodwinking of the American public, unquote. The League president went on to say that what the two campaigns were demanding was outrageous, including the demands that they control the selection of questioners, the composition of the audience, hall access for the press, and other issues. Ever since 1988, the two corporate parties now decide on the format of each debate, who gets to moderate each debate, and which corporate media conglomerate gets to sponsor each debate. And don't expect the National Sierra Club or AFL-CIO to sponsor a presidential debate anytime soon, because that too is now prohibited under the existing contract. Any Democrat or Republican presidential candidate who dares to accept an invitation to an independently hosted debate will be banned from all further televised debates. That means if Bernie Sanders wants to be in the Democrat presidential primary debates, he is not allowed to accept debate invitations from any independent organizations. You can't make this stuff up. These are just two examples among hundreds of how large business corporations now pretty much own the way we govern ourselves here in this nation state that we still strangely refer to as a democratic republic. Although if we're going to be truly honest with ourselves and each other, it much more closely resembles an ever-expanding corporate plutocracy. Clearly, we are on a trajectory here that is heading off the cliff on almost every issue, be it environmental protection, labor and civil rights, or economic justice. So it frightens me when virtually all of the activism I see on the ground across the U.S. is merely focusing on one corporate harm at a time, rather than tackling the root cause of the extraordinary legal and political power being wielded by the corporate business structure. We cannot afford to focus our activism just on corporate cell towers, or just on corporate-controlled presidential debates, or just on corporate money in elections. we have to go to the root of the problem, which is their Supreme Court-granted constitutional rights, which began, believe it or not, way back in 1819, 195 years ago, which is why I'm so passionate about the community rights movement, because I see it as one of the only social movements in the country actually hacking at those rotten roots of the problem, not merely trimming back the newest branches. We need all of us learning about and beginning to tackle corporate so-called rights, and then we will begin to witness the mostly invisible structures of law that hold up this rotten system, collapsing like a house of cards. You've been listening to the Weekly Commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at CNFuegosPaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
Today, the U.S. House Agriculture Committee approved H.R. 1599, the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act of 2015. Known to its critics as the Denying Americans the Right to Know, or DARC Act, the bill will prevent states from requiring the labeling of genetically modified organisms. The bill will go straight to the House floor as early as next week, with no vote in the Energy and Commerce Committee. Laws that have already been passed in Maine, Connecticut, and Vermont would be overturned, and the GMO bans currently in place in three Oregon counties would also be lifted if the bill passes the U.S. House and Senate. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Catherine Paul of the Organic Consumers Association.
And let's just start with the name of the bill. What is wrong with calling it the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act?
What's wrong with that is that it's anything but. First of all, we've never in this country had real independent pre-market safety testing of GMO foods, and this bill would guarantee that that never happens. So we're not talking about safe, and we're not talking about accurate, because accurate would be to tell people what's actually in their food. And this bill will make sure that we never have a law that requires mandatory labeling of GMO foods.
The committee released a statement in which Ranking Member Peterson said consumers increasingly want to know about where their food comes from and how it's produced. I think H.R. 1599 satisfies that demand while also recognizing what we know about the safety of the foods that our farmers produce. What's wrong with that statement by Ranking Member Peterson of the committee?
There are two very wrong things about that. What's right is that consumers do want to know what's in their food and how it's been produced. But again, this bill guarantees that there will be no laws that will require that. And it sets up a voluntary program that's run by the USDA. And we all know what happens when corporations, we give them the option of doing the right thing. They've spent millions to prevent labeling, so there's no reason that they would now suddenly voluntarily label those products. They aren't going to do it.
And if this bill passes through Congress, what will be the implications for places like Vermont that have passed a statewide measure calling for labeling of genetically modified foods, and Hawaii that's currently trying to fight to reinstate a law that was just overturned by a lawsuit from Monsanto that a judge ruled in Monsanto's favor?
This bill is designed to repeal those laws. Vermont's law would no longer be a law. The same goes for Hawaii. The same goes for the GMO crop bans that have been passed in several counties, both in California and Oregon, counties that decided they wanted to have GMO-free zones in order to protect the farmers who are growing conventional and organic crops. and passed laws to prevent the planting of GMO crops, those laws would be overturned.
Well, that could be disastrous for sugar beet farmers here in Oregon, many of whom produce products for export that, if they do get contaminated with GMO seed, could actually prevent them from exporting. Is there a provision for those farmers in this bill?
There's not that I'm aware of. I've not seen any or heard any language about this. I mean, they do not want these laws to pass, and the laws that have already been passed, they want to knock them out as soon as they can. The reason they are pushing this so quickly at the federal level right now is that Vermont's GMO labeling law is set to take effect on July 1st, 2016, and they are going to do everything in their power to prevent that law from taking effect.
So what is your group asking for people to do? Is it to call the Congress people now in the coming week?
Absolutely. I mean, this bill is probably going to be voted on by the full House next week, as early as we've heard conflicting reports, Tuesday, possibly Thursday next week. But the entire House is going to vote on this bill next week. So we continue to urge people to pick up the phone, call their representatives in Congress, and let them know that this is being, it's being falsely portrayed as a bill that's going to give consumers what they want, and it clearly is intended to do exactly the opposite.
Again, I've been speaking with Catherine Paul of the Organic Consumers Association of about H.R. 1599. This bill, if passed, will prevent states and local municipalities from requiring companies to label genetically modified foods. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Preference at 6, hosted by Alan Silver. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear, with a low around 57. Tomorrow mostly cloudy through mid-morning, then gradual clearing with a high near 81. Today is Bastille Day. This French national holiday celebrates the storming of Bastille and the beginning of the French Revolution in 1798. And Loretta Napoleoni reminds us that Europeans are forever the offspring of Machiavelli, trapped in a historical roller coaster that can bring us a monarchy-toppling French Revolution, and then a few years later, Napoleon Bonaparte as emperor.
It's 5:27, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Already, results of the first election of the 2016 presidential race are in. It's the money primary, controlled not by voters, but by super wealthy donors. In this exclusive election, Jeb is way out front of the GOP pack with a record haul of $100 million, while Hillary has bagged $45 million to lead among the Dems. But wait, here come the Koch brothers from out of nowhere, overwhelming all the other campaigns with nearly $1 billion for their secretive effort to put the presidency under their private control. Thanks to the absurd Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court's corporate minions, running for America's highest office in our democratic republic has been perverted into the venality of a gold rush. Candidates shamelessly grub for cash in the suites of corporate plutocrats, molding their policy proposals to fit the narrow interests of those moneyed elites. The donors and political sycophants involved in this obscene corruption of the system are blithely playing with dynamite, By using money to shove the vast majority of people out of the democratic process, they're mocking America's essential egalitarian ideal that we're all in this together, destroying their own moral legitimacy, and fueling an explosive fury among alienated voters. In a recent nationwide poll, 84% of Americans say that money has too much influence in elections, resulting in policies that favor the donors. The majority also rejects the Supreme Court's coddling of fat cat donors, with three-fourths of the people wanting limits on how much any donor can give and demanding that dark money front groups reveal the sources of their money. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the aloof political slash money class won't stop their own corruption, but we the people can and must. To help, go to www.democracyisforpeople.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A report from the United Nations today finds that the world is on track to meet the investment target of $22 billion for the AIDS response by 2015, and that concerted action by the international community can end the AIDS epidemic by 2030. The organization UNAIDS today released its new report titled How AIDS Changed Everything. UNAIDS held a news conference in Vienna to launch the report. So let's hear from Peter Gies, Director of Strategic Information and Evaluation at UNAIDS, to learn more.
First, as of March 2015, 15 million people are receiving life-saving HIV treatment, proving beyond doubt that treatment can be scaled up in resource-poor settings. At the start of the MDGs, antiretroviral treatment was not measured, yet fast forward 15 years, and this ambitious target of reaching 15 million set by the UN member states in 2011 has been met. And with this achievement, we have averted nearly 8 million AIDS-related deaths since the year 2000. Also, to put it in perspective, in the year 2000, there was just about 10,000 people receiving antiretroviral treatment in Africa. And so today, there is more than 15 million people worldwide that receive that type of treatment. Secondly, the world has achieved a 35% decrease in new HIV infections between 2000 and 2014. And by 2014, new infections had been significantly reduced or had not increased in 83 countries. And in sub-Saharan Africa, the region that is most affected by the AIDS epidemic, new HIV infections have declined by 41% over the 15 years. Also, the top five countries that have the highest HIV burden have all reversed their HIV epidemics. This includes South Africa, India, Mozambique, Nigeria, and Zimbabwe. Also, as we look at other regions, we observe that there has been sharp reductions in the Caribbean region, estimated at 50%, and also in the Asia-Pacific region, estimated at 31%. However, there are also few regions where HIV infections have not, in fact, declined over this period and have, in fact, increased. And those regions are Eastern Europe and Central Asia, where HIV infections have increased by 30% between 2000 and 2014. And also the Middle East and North Africa, that also has seen an increase of about 26%. As it comes to AIDS-related deaths have fallen by 42% since the year 2004, which had seen the largest number of AIDS-related deaths in the history of the epidemic. And this, of course, is largely related to the massive rollout of antiretroviral treatment. antiretroviral treatment having the effect of keeping people alive and also healthy. Next, turning to resources. The world has moved from millions to billions for the AIDS response. And investments have gone up to reaching just about $22 billion in 2015. And this can be compared to a target for financial resources that had been set at between $22 and $24 billion. Also, the financial resources that were available in the year 2014 for the AIDS response were in their majority coming from domestic sources, with about 57% from domestic sources. A last area I want to highlight is the area of the prevention of transmission from mothers to children. And first of all, I want to say that around 73% of all pregnant women living with HIV had access to antiretroviral medicines in 2014. And so this provision of antiretroviral medicines together with other approaches has made for a very strong decline in the number of new infections with HIV among babies. And that number has reduced from around 520,000 in the year 2000 to 220,000 in the year 2014. And it represents a reduction of 58%. Also, with that response, about 1.4 million infections among children have been averted.
The Boy Scouts of America are on track to allow LGBTQ adults to join the organization. The executive committee of the organization unanimously approved a resolution to end the ban on gay adult leaders. The group lifted its ban on LGBTQ youth members at the beginning of 2014, but the prohibition on adults remained. However, the measure still needs to be ratified by the National Executive Board, set to make a decision on July 27th. Robert Gates, the Boy Scouts of America president, says the measure is likely to push through. He says that if the organization upholds its ban on gay leaders, it will be the end of BSA as a national movement. Even if the measure goes through, religious chartered groups can continue to choose adult leaders whose beliefs are consistent with their own. Zach Walls is the executive director at the Scouts for Equality and says that, for decades, the Boy Scouts of America's ban on gay adults has stood as a towering example of explicit institutional homophobia in one of America's most important and recognizable civic organizations.
Hawaii's governor signed a bill on Monday to allow trans people to more easily change the gender on their birth certificates. The old law required people to undergo gender reassignment surgery before being able to legally change their gender. Many people in the trans community either can't afford the costly surgeries or have no desire to undergo them. Eliminating the necessity to undergo surgery will allow trans people to more easily use their birth certificate as a document. Having a birth certificate that reflects your gender accurately is critical for school transcripts, job applications, health insurance, and many other aspects of life. Hawaii's law goes into effect immediately. At least six other states have made similar changes to their birth certificate laws, including Oregon, which passed a bill 2 years ago allowing people to change their gender on their birth certificate.
Protesters at the Mauna Kea Observatory site managed to close the road and block access to the telescopes for the past 3 weeks. They had rolled large boulders onto the roadway, halting construction. The access road was reopened just yesterday. Hawaii Governor David Ige released the following statement. The state seeks to provide safe access to Mauna Kea summit by all lawful users. Unfortunately, the destructive actions of several individuals temporarily rendered the mountain road unsafe since June 24th. To put off further protest, the state has restricted access to the road, including the visitor information station and its restroom facilities. The main focus of the protests is a planned 18-story high telescope that would occupy a full 5 acres of land. They also say the land in question is designated as a conservation area, and the mountain itself is considered a holy place to indigenous Hawaiians.
The overall share of American children living in poverty has declined slightly since 2010, but the poverty rate has changed little for African American children, according to a new report by the Pew Research Center. Almost 15 million children in the U.S. lived in poverty in 2013, down from just over 16 million in 2010. The poverty rates for Hispanic, white, and Asian children declined during that period, while the rate for African American children held steady at about 38%. African American children were almost four times as likely as white or Asian children to be living in poverty in 2013. The Pew researchers also reported that there were more Hispanic children living in poverty in 2013 than any other group, more than 5 million children. The researchers noted that while those younger than 18 make up about a quarter of the total population, they comprise about a third of all Americans in poverty. About 27% of the African American population are younger than 18, yet they make up 38% of African Americans living in poverty. Children account for 33% of all Hispanics, but 42% of Hispanics living in poverty.
As Pope Francis headed home from his trip to South and Central America, he was asked about the financial crisis in Greece. In response, the Pope called for an international bankruptcy process. He said that if a company can declare bankruptcy, a country should be able to as well. Pope Francis noted that too many countries are struggling with high debts, and he suggested a United Nations bankruptcy proposal could be the solution. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Andy Hanauer of Jubilee USA.
Could you talk a little bit about the significance of this statement by Pope Francis?
Yeah, well, and first, thanks so much for having me on. It's incredibly significant. It may not be the most headline-grabbing comment that the Pope makes during his trip, but it's incredibly significant because the fact that countries are not able to access bankruptcy protection leads to increased poverty and increased crises like the one we're seeing in Greece right now. It's a common sense protection that we extend to, individuals across our country, and it needs to be extended to countries as well. And so having the Pope endorse that and support that is really significant.
And what would bankruptcy mean in such a scenario for a country that is in a lot of debt to the IMF, World Bank, and to other countries?
So bankruptcy would allow a country to deal with its debt burden in a fair way so that all of its lenders are treated fairly, both the ones that loan money responsibly and also the ones who are acting in a predatory manner. But most importantly, if I go into bankruptcy, one of the things that's factored in by any judge would be how are my little kids going to be able to eat? And the same is true for a country. Bankruptcy would allow a country to have enough money to continue to fund as much social services as it could, and not just pay back as much as possible to as many creditors as possible. Well, I think austerity's track record is pretty clear. I think over the last 5 years, we've seen a third of Greece population in poverty. And I think there's actually pretty broad consensus that austerity just simply does not work. It's not even an ideological form. It's just simply a fact. Certainly, to the degree that we're seeing more austerity, we're probably going to see more suffering as a result.
What do you think the right-wing pundits are? Where are they coming from as far as being self-proclaimed Christians for the most part and yet not being able to listen to this message from Pope Francis?
Well, I think it's interesting, this latest thing that he's done now, calling for bankruptcy for countries, that's not a liberal or progressive issue. That is very much a common sense, middle-of-the-road stance. And so I'm curious to see if there is any pushback on it. He's supporting a lot of the financial reform work that we do, but our work has been historically supported by both conservative Christians and more progressive Christians. President Bush signed one of the bigger debt relief packages was through his leadership, and then Republicans in Congress have supported our work since the beginning. So we're hopeful that on some of these issues it can actually be used to unify people and not divide them along political lines.
I've been speaking with Andy Hanauer. He's with Jubilee USA and has been speaking about the Pope's statement calling for an international bankruptcy process, saying that in response to the Greek debt crisis, if a company can declare bankruptcy, why can't a country do so as well? This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The city of New York has announced that they have reached a $6 million settlement with the family of Eric Garner. But the family of the victim of police violence says the settlement will not slow down their efforts for police reform. Garner's mother, wife, and kids have called on the U.S. Attorney General to bring federal charges against the police officers accused of choking Eric Garner to death a year ago this month. The incident was captured on a cell phone video by a person standing nearby. In the video, Garner says, "I can't breathe," 11 times before he finally collapses and dies. The only person who has faced any charges in the case is the bystander who filmed Garner's murder.
Tysha Allen is claiming in a federal lawsuit that NYPD officers assaulted and falsely arrested her after she filmed a video of Eric Garner. In the lesser-known video, Garner lays incapacitated on the sidewalk while several police and emergency medical workers stand nearby. The more well-known video, which shows the police chokehold on Garner, was filmed by Ramsey Orta, who has been arrested multiple times and harassed by the police along with his family. Tysha Allen claims that months after Garner's death, police arrested her after calling her that B-word that filmed the Eric Garner video. Allen's lawsuit seeks more than $150,000 in damages for the 9-count complaint. The complaint against the department says that Allen was unlawfully imprisoned, unlawfully searched, and subjected to excessive force by the New York police.
Today, President Obama spoke at the NAACP National Convention in Philadelphia. Obama spoke to disparities within the criminal justice system, calling on lawmakers to reduce unduly harsh sentences. Here's Obama at the NAACP convention.
But today I want to focus on one aspect of American life that remains particularly skewed by race and by wealth.